to Joe.
Thank you, Leslie. Can everybody hear me okay?
Okay.
This talk is a little bit different than the kind that you've been getting, which focus on a particular research project of an academic. This talk, I guess, is a kind of backward look at what we've done in the Center for Language and Literature and where we come from theoretically and practically in our program. So as you're coming to the end of your career, you begin to look back and say, how did I get there and what did I do and so forth and so on. So that's what I've tried to do here. And I found it kind of interesting to have this backward journey, and I hope you find it interesting too as I take you along. In the 1970s, some academics and creative writers at the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec developed a new approach to the study of Canadian literature in both English and French, which went on to have a profound influence on Canadian literature programs and research across the country. They call for Canadian writing to be studied by comparing English and French works. The once controversial propositions about comparative study, translation, and bilingualism are now taken for granted in university curricula. I will trace some specific links from this small Quebec university to Alberta and examine their effects on programs at Athabasca to this day. I call this comparative approach the Sherbrooke School. The methodology involves parallel analysis of major texts from French Canadian and English Canadian authors. In a typical Canadian literature seminar at the University of Sherbrooke, a rural novel by Frederick Philip Grove, for example, would be read along with a novel by Ranguet. A novel by Martha Stenzel would be analyzed beside a one by Gabriel Roy. And a Sinclair Ross novel would be studied along with Anne Hébert. The graduate students were encouraged to discuss the similarities as well as the differences among the various works and authors. But let's go back briefly to set the setting for this literary history. Canadian literature as an academic area began in the 1960s against some opposition and criticism. One of the problems was the lack of significant texts and reputable authors to form a critical mass, to form an identifiable body of literature. Any list of names was rather thin at the time. You had Hugh McLennan, Morley Callahan, Margaret Lawrence, Sinclair Ross, Frederick Philip Grove. Mordecai Richler was still in London at the time. Margaret Atwood's first thin novel only appeared in 1969. Michael Ondaatje's first novel came out in 1976. Both Ondaatje and Atwood were still basically writing poetry. The only Canadian author of international reputation at the time was Gabriel Roy. Many of these early Canadian courses in Canadian literature included one of Roy's 9 novels in English translation, and often these novels were treated as if they were English works. In this rather barren context, the Sherbrooke approach of including many French texts looked very promising to several young aspiring Canadianists. Maybe this was one way of dealing with the two solitudes, not just McLellan's novel, but the two solitudes that existed culturally in Canada. The other problem was what we can call the colonial condition. I guess you can go to page 2. The dominant theory in English literature programs in the world at the time, in the 1950s and to the 1970s, was dominated by what we call the new criticism, an Anglo-American invention. We began to learn the new criticism in high school English classes, since our teachers were also taught it with this theory. It was so prevalent in universities that we took it for granted as the major way of reading and interpreting literary texts. The emphasis in the new criticism was on looking at each text as an independent artifact, with little regard for the life, society, history, culture of the author. This is the way we tried to read Canadian literature when we first began these courses. We tried to read these works as if they were removed from the very society we were living in and experiencing. The Sherbrooke School, on the other hand, broke away from this Anglo-American colonial condition and encouraged us to read these works as social, historical, and cultural texts which reflected our society. The Sherbrooke School tried to show these texts as mirroring our bilingual society, which was quite different from the unilingual societies of the UK and the US. We can move to page 3. The debate. The major part of the debate over the politics of language and culture in Canada was and is the question about the nature of our national literature. Can Canadian literature be easily separated into English and French writing? Is there one national literature or two? What is the role of translation? Is there a place for ethnic minority writing? Where is the place for writing by First Nations people, whether it be in one of the official languages, English and French, or one of the native languages? None of these questions have ever been resolved. In the disputes over language and culture in Canadian literature, the small University of Sherbrooke, south of Montreal, became a center of innovation in the 1970s and 80s. Let's go back to 1962. In that year, Ronald Sutherland, then head of the English program at the new Université de Sherbrooke, proposed a new degree program leading to a Master's of Arts in Comparative Canadian Literature. Against opposition and controversy, the program thrived, and in the 1970s was influencing the study of Canadian writing in some other Canadian universities. In his 1971 book, Second Image, which is this one here, Sutherland presented some of the results of his seminars in English and French, which he had with English and French graduate students at Sherbrooke. In the 1970s, Sherbrooke gave many lectures across Canada promoting this comparative approach to Canadian writing. In 1977, he brought out his second book, The New Hero, Essays on Quebec, on Comparative Quebec Canadian Literature, which elaborated and defended his ideas in the first book that through parallel analysis of major texts, we find that Anglophone and Francophone literatures in Canada share many themes and structures. I call this phenomenon the Sherbrooke School, and I must tell you this is not an official title. You're not going to find it in the encyclopedia or Wikipedia. This is sort of something that's sort of unofficial. I mean, we talked about this in the past, but this is maybe the first paper, academic or otherwise, that's talking about the Sherbrooke School. Anyway, I call this the Sherbrooke School because of its widespread influence on the institution that this institution has had and still has on Canadian literature. But let's step back briefly. The study of Canadian Quebec literature included other pioneers at the time in Quebec. We have Gilles Marcotte with his book, Une littérature qui se fait, published in 1962. Clément Moissin with L'âge de littérature canadienne, 1969. Doug Jones with his book, Butterfly on Rock, which is a study of themes in Canadian literature, which published in 1970. And Antoine Sirois with his book, Montréal dans la littérature canadienne, published in 69. We must note that both Jones and Sirois are teaching at the time at Sherbrooke and are part of this new MA program. And at the Université de Montréal, Philip Stratford, another Anglo-Canadian professor, is promoting the study of English and French literature jointly following the Sherbrooke model. His graduate student Larry Schuldes taught at Sherbrooke and later published his collection of criticism, Contemporary Quebec Criticism, which came out in 1979. And all these people were involved in the new Sherbrooke journal, literary journal called Ellipse, which was devoted to Francophone and Anglophone poems published in translation. And there again, they followed the model, right? Each issue was devoted to one Francophone poet and one Anglophone poet, and on matching pages, both the French and the English texts were printed. And then there were several essays or analyses or criticism or interviews with these writers. So they promoted this model of parallel analysis in the journal itself. So that the journal emphasized bilingualism, translation, as some of the core ideas behind the study of Canadian literature. The academics and writers of the Sherbrooke School, I keep talking about writers, but because we're not dealing with just academics, we are dealing with writers. Doug Jones, the professor there, was primarily a poet. He has about 10 books of poetry, and he's won two Governor General's Awards for poetry. So his primary identity is basically as a poet. And even Ronald Sutherland, the head of the department, he published several novels, including L'Arc des Neiges, which became quite a popular film the title of the film was Suzanne, with the actress Cynthia, her sister, Jennifer Dale, playing the lead. And since his, and also Sullivan published many other, he published other books such as Where Did the McDonald's Bury Their Dead, and some other, since he's retired, he's published popular, you know, folk tales and popular short stories, such as one book that strikes me is How Elvis Saved Quebec. You know, this is about the Quebec crisis, and he has Elvis in there, and people, and the Massawappi Monster and Other Friends of Mine. He's sort of gone into writing about popular literature and popular culture in Quebec and English Canada, and how this is. So these people developing the master's program at Sherbrooke basically approached it with a writer's imagination rather than with an academic's problem about, you know, how are you going to do this, how's it going to work, and this sort of stuff. That's the kind of thrust that we have in there. Okay. The academics and writers from Sherbrooke created a kind of zeitgeist for the comparative approach of Canadian writing. So they were spreading this message across Canada. Their emphasis on bilingualism, translation, and parallel analysis influenced other developments at the time. One indication is the founding of ACQL, which is the Association of Canadian and Quebec Literatures in 1970, at the height of the separatist Quebec crisis, right? This association has from the beginning included both Anglophone and Francophone academics and writers. At one of these meetings of the ACQL, Doug Jones read his seminal paper, Grounds for Translation, in which he argues that English and French writers need each other in order to understand each other, because they both inform and reflect each other's cultures. So that's sort of the kind of idea behind this writing, behind this school. Okay. Yes, I think page number 5. Okay. It's okay. That doesn't necessarily parallel. It's sort of a counterpoint to what I'm saying. I didn't want it to just sort of be notes from here. Okay. How do the universities of Alberta and Athabasca link to this Quebec school, the Sherbrooke School? Okay. In 1977-78, Mary Hamilton was teaching English at the University of Sherbrooke. In 1979, Mary Hamilton and two bilingual graduate students, Francis McCree and Barbara Bellier, moved from Sherbrooke to the University of Alberta to pursue PhDs in comparative literature, and brought with them the Sherbrooke ideas and approaches to their new school. But there's an interesting footnote here. One of the graduate students, Francis McCree, had his MA from Sherbrooke in comparative Canadian literature. But when he got to Alberta, in good faith, they said, well, what is this? What kind of a degree is this? Is this really a master's? You know? So they created so much a problem with him that he basically had to re-enroll and get another master's in comparative literature. You know? That's to give you an idea of what we're dealing with, you know, from 1969 to later, how this changed dramatically. Anyway, these students, when they saw this problem, they encouraged their Alberta professor, E.D. Blodgett, who was also a poet, to go to Sherbrooke as a visiting professor for a term. In addition, many of the academics from Sherbrooke, Sutherland, Jones, Sirois, were invited to give lectures and seminars at the University of Alberta. When I began my master's, my MA at the University of Alberta in 1970, I attended many of these visiting lectures, seminars, and I came under the influence of these people, an influence which has lasted to this day. In 1979, a special issue of the Canadian Review of Comparative Literature, which was published in Alberta, was devoted to the practical and theoretical questions of the comparative study of Canadian and Quebec literatures. This issue included contributions from the Sherbrooke and Montreal people I've named, and also from other people such as David Hain at the University of Toronto. He was a French professor at the University of Toronto. And in 1982, Ted Blodgett, E.D. Blodgett, published Configurations, Essays on Canadian Literatures, on the Canadian Literatures, a collection of essays which promoted comparative study of Canadian writing. So from 69, when they rejected the first MA, to 82 was a big change, right? A big transformation took place. I guess we can move to page 6 at this point. We're already there. Good. Okay. In 1979-1980, Sutherland was a visiting professor at the University of Calgary, which later hired Barbara Bellier, one of these students from Sherbrooke, and Estelle Danseau, another graduate student from the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Alberta, so that the comparative approach, the Sherbrooke School, was also transported to Calgary, and it was reflected in some of the programs that developed there. When I completed my PhD in comparative literature in 1977, under the supervision of Ted Blodgett, I was hired at the then new Athabasca University. Our colleague Mary Hamilton had been hired a couple of years before in 1975. We both brought the Sherbrooke perspective to our new course in Canadian literature, which at that time was English 302, which opened in 1979, which included five major texts by Quebec writers, including two novels by Gabriel Roy, and an English translation, and a collection of poems by Doug Jones. So we were really into the Sherbrooke School with a vengeance. In 1982, when I opened my new course in Comparative A Literature, which was English 350, I included Sutherland's book, The Second Image, which at that point was out of print, and of course I had the Athabasca Press reprint it. We kept it in print for another decade. Okay. Eventually, my comparative literature courses included other people, other critics, which became part of his tradition. And half my texts in English 350, which was a six-credit course, were French texts and English translations. So I was very much into the Sherbrooke School. The Sherbrooke School of Canadian Literature influenced all my critical work and literary studies. Ronald Sutherland's book, Second Image and the New Hero, and Doug Jones' Butterfly and Rock promoted a comparative approach to the study of Canadian writing. English language writing in Canada could be better understood in comparison to and contrast with French language writing. Gabriel Roy, Van Gay, Anne Baer were translated into English and studied in Canadian literature courses across the country. When I published my article, Eight Approaches to Canadian Literary Criticism in the Journal of Commonwealth Literature in 1979, an article which, by the way, was rejected by a whole bunch of Canadian journals in Canada, because I was arguing for a comparative approach for bilingual critics and academics, for using translation, under the influence of Jones and Sutherland. The people in the UK, they said, well, this should be normal for Canada, but my fellow academics in Canada said, well, no, you can't make English professors bilingual, which is, I guess that's a problem. In my first article in the Journal of Canadian Literature, which appeared in 1973, and this is while I was still an MA student at the U of A, it was devoted to Godbout's novel, Nouveau Roman, Le Couteau sur la Table, which had won the Governor General's Award a couple of years before that. So I was very much into this mindset of the Sherbrooke School. So when I began to work, just soon after that, on Italian-Canadian writing, it was natural for me to take the comparative approach to use the Sherbrooke School because these writers, these Italian-Canadian writers, were writing in English. Those in Quebec were writing in French, and some of the other immigrants were writing in Italian. So we're dealing with one body of literature in three languages. So you have to use the Sherbrooke approach, using translation and back and forth. Are we behind here with the pages? Probably. Okay. In 1984, I published Contrast, Comparative Essays on Canadian Literature, on Italian-Canadian Literature, which I didn't realize at the time became very influential in the critical study of other ethnic minority writers in Canada, which was not something that was just emerging at the time. And in 1994, I brought out Echo, Essays on Other Literatures, which continued to promote comparative analysis. So I was very much under this influence. Mary Hamilton retired in 2008 from Athabasca University, and I'm looking at that transition very soon. Will the comparative approach to the Sherbrooke School fade away with our departure? Well, I hope not. Over the years, Athabasca has hired a number of doctoral candidate graduates from the comparative literature program at the University of Alberta. Both Jolene Armstrong, who is now on maternity leave, and Manajay Manani, who is not here because he's in Europe, have studied under E.D. Blodgett and are now carrying on with our comparative literature courses in the Center for Language and Literature and developing new courses. For example, just to give you an idea, one of the comparative literature courses that Manajay inherited by me, she introduced another angle. She introduced this book on Voices in the Desert, an anthology of Arab Canadian women writers. So there again, you have to have a compare because you have Arab women writers who are writing in French in Quebec and are writing in English in Canada, and they're dealing with this problem of being Arab in Canada, right? There's a very interesting essay here on wearing the veil, a very kind of controversial, academic woman saying, Arab women should not wear the veil in Canada, which is very much a controversy going on right now, right? So this comparative approach is being carried on this way. just to mention other examples, other doctoral candidates in the comparative literature program include Evelyn Ellerman and Patricia Hughes Fuller. And even our past president, Dominique Abreu, who was hired as the first French professor, has a PhD from the comparative literature program at the University of Edinburgh. In fact, I should, as a footnote to that, when we began the French language program in 1979-80, it was basically under this influence of bilingualism, you know, being Canadian, and there was this kind of atmosphere at the university. And at that time, our vice president academic, John Daniel, was bilingual himself, having earned his doctorate from Paris, the Sorbonne in Paris. So there was very much support within the university for pushing ahead with a French language program. Okay. Now, page number 8. Okay. The Sherbrooke School and other universities. Because I keep claiming it's spread, so here's one example. In 1972, another Sherbrooke MA student, John Lennox, went to York University to teach Canadian literature and later published many articles on Quebec authors in English, right? He worked closely with Clara Thomas, one of the first researchers in the study of Canadian women writers. You know, Clara Thomas was like a pioneer in women writers at the time, against much opposition, and I think she was one of the first people to promote Canadian literature courses at York at the time, in the 1960s. One of the colleagues that Lennox met at York was Barbara Goddard, a bilingual feminist scholar who shared many of the ideas from the Sherbrooke School. In fact, Barbara had earned her master's from the Université de Montréal under Philip Stratford, so she was also part of this group. One of the most important group of writers in Quebec were the women novelists, Gabrielle Roy, Anne Hébert, Marie-Claire Blaise, Nicole Boissard. So feminist literary criticism in Canada had to become bilingual to deal with these writers and theorists. And this is reflected in the establishment of the bilingual of a feminist journal, Tessera, which Barbara Goddard co-founded and edited for many, many years. Tessera, which is a bilingual journal. So feminism in Canada, feminist theory and writing in Canada, is different from that in the States because we have this bilingual dimension. We have more reciprocity with feminist theorists in France, for example. So it's that's kind of a difference. Okay, let's move. The University of Toronto. At the University of Toronto, Linda Hutchin, which you might have heard of as a major scholar and theorist, her early career began translating Quebec novels into English. One of her novels, she translated the novel of Félix Lérec, which is called Allegro, published in 1974, and Madeleine Gagnon's Loué, which is published in 1980. So Hutchins' knowledge, Hutchins' bilingualism is informed several of her books that she published. One of the controversial books is The Canadian Postmodern, which came out in 1989, and Splitting Images, Contemporary Canadian Ironies. Irony is one of Hutchins' big theoretical areas. So her knowledge of languages informs her whole research and thrust into postmodernism. And more recently, she's gotten involved in writing about opera, so opera and literature, opera and popular culture. So the knowledge of the other language, the idea of translation, the idea of adaptation is very much part of the central to her research and publication. So she's influenced part by this Sherbrooke School. So which is not reflected by her predecessor Northrop Frye. Northrop Frye was very, even though Northrop Frye is actually from Sherbrooke. Once he was born, he's very much a bilingual, a unilingual Canadian critic, right? Everything was basically looking at English language texts in all his criticism. And the Sherbrooke School has also influenced many younger academics. I'll just mention a few here because I'm familiar with them. In 1995, Marino Tutsi completed a PhD on ethnic minority fiction under the supervision of John Lennox at York University. And in 98, Licha Cantong completed a PhD in Canadian ethnic minority writing at the University of Montreal. And she also published several books looking at ethnic minority writing, translation, and so forth. So a friend of hers, a colleague of hers at that University of Montreal, Dominic Benvenuti, who earned his PhD there, again looking at ethnic minority writing, Quebec literature, and he is now teaching at the University of Sherbrooke. So these these people circle around these in these, and so this, the Sherbrooke tradition is very much alive. This is a brief outline of the cultural, academic, and political context of the development of the Sherbrooke School for Comparative Canadian Literature. Many academics have been influenced by it. The debate about the nature of Canadian literature carries on, and the Sherbrooke School will continue to contribute to the discourse. So, let's get back to today now. Let's see. Yes, page 9. Yes, dear, page 9. Blaine, Veronica. Two recent events prompted me to review this recent history of me, our department, and our literature programs at Athabasca. One was Veronica Thompson's radical revision of the Canadian literature course. She inherited the course from Mary Hamilton, English 302. And the other was the work of the bilingual writer Antonio D'Alfonso. Veronica Thompson first. The Sherbrooke approach to Canadian literature is what I have used in all my research and publications in ethnic minority writing, and also my courses at Athabasca University for over 30 years. It informs all my courses, all my writing, but it is an approach that I have come to take for granted, right? I assume this is the right way of doing things. This is true until our colleague Veronica Thompson distributed her phase 3 or phase 4 report on the new English 302 course, which she has created. This new English 302 course is a total revision of the old course, which has been in Athabasca since 1979. When I saw the list of texts, I was surprised by a number of changes. Most of the most significant changes is the omission of all Quebec texts, especially WL1. I'm not saying this is bad, I'm just saying this is a different change which sort of struck me. The new version of English 302 is all about English language texts. This made me realize that some of my colleagues are reading Canadian writers in a different context and teaching them with different approaches. And Veronica's approach is very much post-colonial theory and feminist theory. Her PhD is from Australia. And of course, some people take other theory, you know, deconstruction, reader response theory, and so forth and so on, moving away from that. And we must admit, of course, that Veronica has a much larger number of novels to choose from than we did in 1979. So in 30 years, the critical mass of Canadian literature has changed dramatically. You couldn't compare the two. So, and she's reflecting this in the new course. Her answer to me when I asked her about this is that basically we should have a separate course on Quebec literature and English translation, because there too there's lots of changes. So maybe this will take away from some of the comparative analysis in this course, but certainly the comparative analysis lives on in the other comparative literature courses. And the other thing that prompted me to do this was Antonio D'Alfonso. Some months ago, I was asked to write a critical introduction to a collection of essays on the works of Antonio D'Alfonso, a bilingual poet and novelist from Montreal who's lived in Toronto for the past 15 years. As I was reading his novels in English and the French versions, I was reminded that Antonio epitomizes the Canadian writer as idealized by the Sherbrooke School. He heroically tried to deal with English language and culture and French language and culture in his long career. And therefore, in writing about Antonio, I was also forced to look back and explore what the Sherbrooke School had done to my writing and my research, and also how it had influenced us at Athabasca University. So these two events, Veronica Thompson and Antonio D'Alfonso, made me look back to see how we had arrived at this stage. So that's what I've done. I've taken this little piece of probably insignificant literary history and reviewed it and see how Athabasca fits into the larger picture of comparative Canadian writing. The interesting thing that struck me was that a few creative people at a small and relatively insignificant Quebec university, insignificant even in Quebec, the University of Sherbrooke, had such a profound influence at Canadian literature courses and studies across Canada. And this is an example that our small Athabasca University maybe should be mindful of in terms of what influences we might exert in the future. Thank you for listening to me. I hope that was all picked up by this thing.
Thanks, Joe, for a very interesting perspective, really. So do you think people miss stuff in translation, or do you think we should actually be bilingual enough that all of us Anglo-Canadians should be able to read the French literature in French, which probably isn't going to happen for some of us, but there you go, there's the question.
Well, ideally, yes. Ideally, we should be promoting bilingualism in our literature departments. At the very least, professors that are Canadian, that are teaching Canadian literature, should at least have a reading knowledge of French. They should be able to at least read some of that, some of those texts in French. You know, and I think this is the case in many areas. It's just that now with things such as post-colonial and other theories coming in, it doesn't seem to be as important because you're looking at Canadian literature in the wider context and sort of the links with Quebec seem to be de-emphasized. So I guess this paper is sort of reminding us of that. One of the examples I didn't mention, which I had scribbled on the side, is, for example, our colleague Anne Nottoff. She's not part of this comparative literature group from the University of Alberta, but yet in her courses in Canadian drama, she very much has Quebec authors. I mean, I have the printout. She has Michel Tremblay, Michel Marc Bouchard, Robert Lepage. I mean, you really can't have a credible course in Canadian drama and leave out Quebec dramatists. Anne Nottoff, who has basically her training is all in English, she realizes she has to look at that literature. So that's sort of what we're arguing. You know, we have to look at the whole picture when we're looking at Canadian literature, and not just the English language literature. In Mary Hamilton's Literature of the Canadian West, for example, she was able to include Gabrielle Roy because Roy is from Manitoba, right? And two of her novels take place in Manitoba, and one novel is set in the north. So, you know, you're able to include French writers in other parts of Canada. And in my comparative literature course, I have Georges Bounier, who's a French language writer from Alberta. You know. That's a long answer to your short question.
Thanks. Any other questions?
I have a question. You mentioned that this course is changing and there will be a separate course on Quebec literature. It sort of sounds to me, not being a literature person, like a new kind of ghettoizing, which I thought we were getting away from. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, basically, my colleagues have taken over and they have to make the decisions. I can't second-guess them, and I presume they're going to make good decisions. The thing is that we have a number of comparative Canadian literature courses now, which are quite innovative, you know, with new things coming out. So I have to trust that the other colleagues are going to be carrying on this in other ways. I mean, it's going to be another kind of comparative Canadian literature. It's not going to be just, Quebec English, French. It's going to also include ethnic minority writers, which I do that in my courses. I include ethnic minority writer, and Manager is including, you know, other ethnic minority writers. So I mean, we're looking at a new kind of Canadian literature. It has to include other voices.
Okay, that's very broad-minded. What does it say about your own particular research, which has focused on Italian Canadian writing, primarily a form of literature from the margins, but a very different margin than, say, post-colonialism or feminism. And I wondered where there would be room for your kind of interests in such an approach.
Well, I always hope there will be room for other voices. We've had this argument at home for a while now, so.
I just have a question. In terms of the sort of comparative approach, what kinds of lessons could you summarize, you know, between the French-English cultures, or what does the comparative approach provide that, say, other approaches would not?
Well, I mean, from an academic point of view, from a literary point of view, I mean, these people argue, and I would support them, that it helps you to better understand the literature in both languages. You know, so Quebec writers are better understood if they look in the context of the larger nation, and also English language writers are looked at understood if they looked at it because well, for, just to give you an example, a very common image, death in the snow. That's a common image you have in prairie novels. And you think, if you look at a prairie novel, you say, well, yeah, it's a prairie phenomenon, but you look at death in the snow, it's a recurring image in Quebec writing. Even Marie Chapdelaine, you know, her boyfriend dies in the snow. You say, well, obviously this is an experience that we share. It's an image that haunts our literature, our culture, this kind of stuff. And it's reflected in two parallel literatures, and you say it's better if you look at this together, and you see the similarities and contrasts. You know that you know, for example, in Marie Chapdelaine, death in the snow is treated with a very religious way, right? Whereas in the prairie novels, in Philip Ross or Sinclair Ross or Philip Grove, it's more secular. You know, when somebody dies in the snow, it's because of other things happening. So that's the difference, but. The image and the phenomenon and the haunting of it is very similar. That's kind of an example that occurs. That's one of the first things that strikes you. So somebody writing on the prairie novel and they neglect that whole aspect, they say, well, you know, they should be aware that some of these phenomenons occur in Quebec. I mean, Sullivan's favorite example, of course, he has. Philip Grove and Ryan Gay, because they're looking at novels of the soil. Well, the novel of the soil is a staple of the prairie novel, right? It's a novel of the soil. Well, there are novels of the soil in Quebec, where people are obsessed with their land and they're tied with their land, and it becomes you have these kind of parallels. And you say, well, these are similar obsessions. Similar. What are the differences? What are the similarities in these two novels? So that's those are the kind of things you look at, and you understand your cultural context better because you understand that it's a phenomenon you share with other parts of Canada, right? Yes. Yes.
Okay. It's a two-part question. The first is with your own research. Okay, when you're reading a French text, you're going to be having the English translation beside you. Do you ever have the French translation when you're reading an English novel to see how their understanding the English novel, has that augmented your research? And then the other thing is, do any of these texts have multiple translations that require?
Yes, Gabriel Roy's Bonheur d'Occasion, The Tin Flute, exists in a couple of translations, you know, because they wanted to produce a more modern translation for the newer audience rather than the one from 1947 or something. So there's a different translation. I can read the French, so I don't necessarily have to have the English text there, unless I'm looking at translation and even Italian Canadian works. If you're looking at the problem of translation, because you suspect something is going on there, for example, the text is changing when it's put into the other language to be more offensive or more or less offensive, you know, this kind of stuff. That then you look at that and say, well, why did he change that image, or why did he make that, more amenable to an English audience or more amenable to a French audience? That's the kind of thing you can look at and say, well, why did the translator do that? These are translation problems that you want to look at and say, well, are these political decisions? Are these artistic decisions? Are these, why did he do this? You know, did the author have a say in how the thing was translated? Because some of these authors, of course, can read the English. Well, I don't like the way you translated that. You want to change this, you know. That. So all these problems are interesting problems. I mean, they're the kind of problems that students take up in PhD theses, right? And say, you know, why was this translated this way? And you know, what happened? What's going on here? And so forth and so on. Yeah. But that's all part of the phenomenon, right? Of was there a second part to your question? Or?
Have you ever looked at the
Have you ever looked at the gained insight into an English text by reading a translation? Like to go, oh. Have you ever had that sort of experience?
Not a Quebec text. I read there's a war memoir from an internment camp by What's his name now? Oh, I forget now. Yeah. Anyway, he was an Italian journalist who was interned during the Second World War, and he wrote an account. And he was a French journalist because he was writing for Le Devoir. So he wrote an account, and he published it. He published one version in French and one version in Italian. And the French version is different from the Italian version. Right? So the Italian version is very pro-Italian, very defensive, so forth, you know. And the French version is very much nationalistic French. I mean, you know, the actual sentences are framed differently. And I mean, he's doing both writing, right? So it's his own translation. So, you know, he's doing this intentionally because he wants it to appeal to two different audiences, you know. So when we looked at this, because only in 96 was this book translated into English. It's called, in English, City Without Women. La Ville Sans Femmes, right? These internment camps were men only. So when it came to translate into English, a poet, an Italian Canadian poet translated it in English, he had to look at both texts, you know, and say, well, which one do I translate? Do I translate the Italian version or the French version? You know, one has a different flavor because of the audiences he was dealing with. I mean, it's after the war, he doesn't want to offend anybody, Italians are still considered the enemy, so he's trying to appeal to both of them, you know, trying to soothe the Italian audience and trying to soothe the French-Canadian audience. So that's not English-French, that's English, that's Italian-French. Yes, Mark.
Yeah, I got a comment about the individual work and then a question about the national context. So the comment about the individual work is that it occurs to me there are a few texts where you can actually, within an individual text, right, do a comparative analysis. I'm thinking more of like some dramatic texts like by Thompson Highway, where you have English alongside First Nations languages sort of being spoken, and not necessarily with any kind of translation, leaving the audience in many cases just to figure it out. There was a recent movie, Bon Cop, Bad Cop, right, which is a kind of split Quebec, Canada, French, English production. So it occurs to me there are a number of texts you can do a comparative analysis in where you're not even looking at translations from one entire language into another entire language, but that within certain individual texts you can find a lot, I think, for comparative reading. So that's the comment. The question, and it's about the kind of national context. I was really interested in the way you put the ACQL founding, you know, during the separatist movement's peak, right? And so I guess my question is sort of about bringing a kind of a micro-colonial perspective to what's going on between English and French within Canada. I mean, I think you can do the post-colonial thing with English and French in Canada in terms of, you know, how an English majority manages a French minority population, even though they're both languages are on the books as official languages, right? So is there like a diversity management rationale for, I mean, that's sort of why we have multiculturalism policy in one respect is to be able to manage potentially unruly populations like we'd see in a separatist movement. So does the ACQL, for instance, have a role in containing some of that or in moderating some of that kind of dissent?
I never looked at it that way. Maybe I'm naive. I imagine the Federalist Quebec academics and writers that want to join can, and the ones that don't join, you know. But I mean, it was seen as a bridge between these two groups. I mean, how do you establish an association of writers and academics in Canadian writing? Do you establish two separate? I mean, you have, for example, acute, which is English language professors, and you have I don't know what the French one is. You know, French language professors, and they don't because they're teaching two different languages and literatures. You know, but when you have one with Canadian literature, I guess it's logical that you have to deal with both. Or do you have two separate entities? You know, I mean, it's interesting that it's called Canadian and Quebec literatures. You know, not Canadian, English Canadian, and French Canadian. They want to be, you know. So there was that, you know, compromise in the title. I mean, it's still called that way. I mean, it doesn't, you know, which sort of leaves out all the other French people in other parts of Canada. You know, but I mean,
René Lévesque said they're all dead ducks, right? It's only Quebec that matters, right? I resisted using the term, well, the Sherbrooke School is basically a kind of federalist model, because, what about all the French students that participated in it and the French academics and writers? I mean, are they all federalists? I mean, they would deny that. They're very much Québécois. The interesting thing is, Sherbrooke is in the eastern they call the eastern townships, yeah. And there, all these small towns have been English and French for generations, and they're very harmonious working together. So I mean, it comes from this kind of Ron Hasselman would go home to North Hatley, and his neighbors, French neighbors, he'd say, well, why can't this be at the university program? We're getting along here. We're not into this, So it's a kind of microcosm. And there was lots of writers and artists and poets and so forth that lived south of Montreal in the eastern township. So it sort of reflected that kind of local culture. So, it came from the roots. It wasn't imposed by Ottawa or the University of Toronto. I mean, that's the whole issue. It came from these people.
I know. I see you've done a really good job of establishing this history, as one of trying to develop communication and conversation across the cultures. I guess I was sort of asking, despite that rationale, if there would be effects of co-optation and containment that would go along with it. So. Yeah, thanks for the answer. It's good.
I mean, the University of Sherbrooke is a French university, so the only little enclave, Anglo enclave, is the English department. So it's a French university that this came out of. It didn't come out of bishops or McGill or and one of the strongest supporters was the English program at the University of Montreal. So you have these. These are people that are living in a bilingual environment. They're living with French people, and so that they have a different perspective than someone from Toronto. Or just this is normal. Yeah. I mean, this is
Joe, just looking at the comparative model, which I've come from of those schools as well, but I'm just wondering, I mean, there is a, there's been a lot of recent discussion within comparative schools as well, I mean, it's kind of like the crisis of comparativism itself, and partly when you look at this sort of classical model of comparing the two cultures, the two literatures, you're sort of assuming, I guess, a unity of French literature or Quebec culture, a unity of Anglo literature, and it's just not possible today. I guess the problem, I'm thinking of Veronica sort of exploding this idea of what Canadian literature is, and thinking about, well, how do you accommodate, right? That's a horrible word, but this idea of accommodating literatures and identities within a single body of Canadian literature. How do you do all that? Because we do have a separate Native Canadian literature,
yes.
Of course, correct?
Because other ethnic minority groups too, yes.
Which is missing on the 302, right? There are no Native writers on 302 at the
Well, I mean, there was very little in 1979. Yeah. I guess the problem with 302 is that it remained pretty well. I mean, there were minor revisions. The reading list is pretty well what it was in 79.
Yeah.
Whereas my courses, 350, when I broke it up into two half courses, 351 and 451, and I was able to bring in Italian Canadian and Manager was able to bring in Arab Canadian, and you have Haitian Canadians writing in French, all kinds of things have happened, and Rohinton Mystery and Visanji, and I have both people in my course now in my 551 course, which is the one I offer in Mays. So you have to keep up and reflect what the conditions are at the time.
Yeah, but comparativism itself is under, they're sort of revising their own approaches and things.
Well,
it's
been in crisis since I was arrived. It's always been in crisis because it's comparative literature programs have always had too many links to politics.
Yeah.
For example, it became apparent to me that the comparative literature programs in America, these are the ones that look at European literature, were always supported during the Cold War. Once the Berlin Wall came down, they weren't important anymore. It was like it was like the Christian Democratic Party in Italy. Who needs support of that anymore? Communism is down. We don't need these Eastern Europeans telling us about, you know, Hungary or Eastern Europe. So it was that kind of a, you know, it was that kind of identity crisis. You know, well, I mean, whereas in Canada, I didn't have the support, you know, and in Canada, we always had, the other language, which permitted us to, which, you know, I mean, the fact that we had Quebec, I mean, to answer your question, Mark, is the fact that we had Quebec permitted multiculturalism rather than multiculturalism, you know, undermining Quebec, you know, because it's sort of the edge of the wedge. So, I mean, you can't have that kind of multiculturalism in Australia or the UK or the States. And even though, you know, there's huge populations of Spanish-speaking people in the States, you're never going to have that multiculturalism that you have, because here you say, well, there's always that second language, which means there could be a third or a fourth language, you know. You accept the other culture, you can accept a third or a fourth culture. And so for you, in Quebec, you have Haitian writers writing in French, you know, Arab writers writing in French. And the Quebecois say, well, these are Quebec writers too. They're writing in our language. They're talking about our culture. I mean, they're not pure land anymore, right? They're not, you know, from the, they didn't arrive with Cartier, but they're Quebecois, you know. Their kids are going to French school and they're marrying our daughters and so forth and so on. So, you know, you have to, that changes, it's changing Quebec society as well, you know. And also, they have to depend on these people to have Quebec society grow, the French part of the Quebec society grow, you know. So they have to review their ideas about ethnicity and what Quebecois really means. So, yeah. Any other questions? Are there anything online there? No, it's just Kathy, and I think she's. Okay, that's it. Thank you for coming on this cold day, on this long weekend. Yes, if you want to look at the books. Yes, this is my seminal book here at the time. You know, that all kinds of things. And in the 551 course, I have this collection of criticism by Crystal Verdun, which has, you know, essays on ethnic minority writing from Quebec. You know. Essays in French on ethnicity in Quebec. So that's, you know, that's the kind of change that's taken place, which would probably never have happened in 1970, but in 1996, when this is published, it's very much a reality.
Kathy just posted a comment that the same thing is happening in German literature. A new
yes, the Turkish writers in Germany. Yes, yes, and there's also Italian writers in you know, Italian immigrants in Germany who are writing in German. Yeah, that's changing the identity of the German identity. What is a German? Right? Because they're very much into the blood, right? And even France, right? The blood, the French blood, German blood, right? So suddenly, you have to look at that again. Yeah, the woman that won the Nobel Prize in literature is, but she was Romanian, living in Germany, writing in German. So is she a German writer? Is she a Romanian writer? You know, she just won the Nobel Prize yesterday, right? Well, you know, that's just a change. Well, you know what? You know, what kind of writer is she? She's probably a German writer because she won a Nobel Prize, right? This is a German Nobel Prize. It's German literature. This kind of... Okay. Okay, thank you, Kathy. Thank you for the question. I guess that's it. I guess maybe I read too fast, right?